Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of New Books in Political Science. I'm your host, Joe Renoir. My guest today is Dr. Adam Hilton, who is Assistant Professor of Politics at Mount Holyoke College. We'll discuss his new book, which is titled True Blues, The Contentious Transformation of the Democratic Party, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press in 2021. Dr. Hilton, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Joe.
Before we get to your new book, tell us a bit about your background and your interests and what interested you in this subject.
Yeah, well, this book grew out of a dissertation I completed under the supervision of the late, great Leo Panitch in Toronto at a moment when it was sort of midway through the Obama presidency, the enthusiasm that had greeted the outset of that presidency, the enthusiasm for change, the promise of a postpartisan politics, that enthusiasm was certainly on the wane. By then. And so I was interested in thinking about the possibilities and challenges facing progressives in and around the Democratic Party, especially in the face of a rising Republican conservatism. And that drew me to examine the struggles within the Democratic Party at the end of the New Deal era, in the late 1960s, early 1970s, a period of great upheaval in society and in the party system as a whole. And I really wanted to use that political history to dig into kind of the big, meaty questions about what parties are, how and why parties change over time. And then as I was completing my graduate work, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump burst onto the scene, underscoring kind of for me that this was, you know, not only an important phenomenon worth studying because it was occurring out in the real world, but that political scientists who nearly unanimously expressed surprise at both the success of both those insurgencies, that they really lacked adequate explanations for that success. And so I set about revising the dissertation, as so many of us do in the early parts of our career, into the book that is now True Blues.
Great. Well, you know, you're not alone in being inspired by the unusual political events of the last decade. And, you know, we have so much to talk about with this book. I'll say at the outset, I really enjoyed it. This is a great work of a political history that also brings us up to the present. And it would interest a lot of our readers for both of those reasons. But your central question, who governs political parties, is very relevant to us. And it seems to me you're entering into longstanding arguments about party evolution, the American political development tradition, APD. And, you know, you alluded to this a moment ago, but lay out the central argument and what's new about your work and what have other scholars missed or what are you building on that they have laid out for us?
Yeah, the book, as you mentioned, sets out with asking, you know, one of those, the great Robert Dahl kind of fundamental question about politics, who governs, but it applies that question to parties. And as you also rightly point out, political scientists have in their own way been arguing about who governs parties for many decades. there's kind of been two ways, if we're going to paint with some broad brushstrokes, there are about two ways of answering that question. One tradition stretches, you know, back to the work of economists like Joseph Schumpeter in the 1940s, Anthony Downs in the 1950s, but continuing right up to the present through the work of folks like John Aldrich. And they see parties as creatures of politicians. Politicians in government need to create parties to resolve the collective action problems that legislators face in conducting log rolls and reducing transaction costs and of course, winning re-election. You know, party activists, other secondary players might have an important role to play, but it's politicians for these researchers who are in the driver's seat, if you will. More recently, another tradition has emerged that sees parties as creatures of groups in society, specifically what those who we could call the UCLA school refer to as intense policy demanders. But you could even go back to some of the work stemming out of the Marxist tradition that sees parties as reflections of classes or other groups in society. And for these researchers, it's groups that are the principals of party action, and it's politicians that are their agents. So in my book, I depart from both these schools and theorize parties to be what I call contentious institutions. That is, because political parties are intermediary institutions, they bridge that divide between the state and civil society. Parties, they necessarily encompass within them both politicians and groups. For me, neither can be excluded from the picture. Parties are simultaneously creatures of politicians in government and agents of groups in society. So for me, what previous researchers have missed is that this dual nature of parties, being simultaneously having one foot in the state and one foot in society, makes the exact location of party authority inherently ambiguous. Both politicians and groups can and do lay claim to be the true and authentic voice in party affairs. In fact, I argue, the question of who governs parties is a question whose answer is perpetually unsettled. And this creates a dynamic tension between groups and politicians that's at the center of party politics. So turning from theory to the empirical side of the book and the historical argument, I use this contentious institutions framework to trace the evolution of the Democratic Party since the late 1960s, looking at it as a series of recurrent bouts of contentious struggle between office holders and groups, reformers and counter-reformers, social movements and presidents, and on and on. And I argue that the outcome of this long period of struggle was a novel configuration of the Democratic Party, what I call an advocacy party. What I mean by that is the Democratic Party has become increasingly dependent on a broad category that I just label advocates, but by which I mean advocacy organizations, public interest groups, more traditional interest groups, social movement activists. And what these folks do is they sort of compensate for the party's internal incapacity in terms of its organization. They help build an electorally viable coalition. And perhaps most importantly, in this age where representative institutions poll so low in public opinion, these movements, these advocates, these groups, they lend the party legitimacy. That is, people often vote Democratic or support the party or a candidate because of the causes that that candidate or the party as a whole are able to associate with.
Well, it's a very important point. I mean, you've raised the argument that you're entering into debates over party power, party control in our country, in our duopoly. And that's a more broadly applicable set of arguments. But your focus is the Democratic Party. And I do have to ask you this a scholarly literature question. Why has there been so much more of an interest in the GOP evolution and so much less on the Democratic Party?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it was one that I was well aware of going into a study of this kind. The literature that you could pile up, next, if you piled one book after another about the evolution of the GOP and its relationship with conservatism, say, since, the Second World War, it would go nearly to the moon. And of course, I'm exaggerating, but there is a lot of literature and fascination with the evolution and the changes, and arguably what now many folks are calling the radicalization of the Republican Party over the last several generations. And, Joe, rightly so. The Republican Party development has been perhaps the most important change in American politics in the last 30 or so years, of course, with roots extending deeper into history than that. And as a lot of the literature about Democratic backsliding is reflecting, this development has portends an ominous future for American politics. And so we have a good reason to be really concerned with figuring out what's going on in the Republican Party. That said, things have not been static on the other side of the aisle. And in addition to there just simply being a dearth of monographic studies about the evolution of the Democratic Party since the 1960s, it occurred to me that there had been actually really profound transformations on the Democratic side that I wanted to better understand, and that I think we're at a moment now, within the first few years of the Biden administration, that actually a lot of those transformations that went unobserved or overlooked over the past 30 or so years are manifesting themselves in pretty dramatic ways now. So I think in addition to just trying to, if you will, rebalance the scholarly interest in America's two parties in a modest way, one intention with the book was to, explain, well, why was Bernie Sanders, why was that insurgency so surprising? Not that he won, but in the traction it seemed to grab. How do we explain Joe Biden's fairly surprising embrace of a bold progressive policy agenda, despite having razor-thin majorities in Congress? I think this book can help us understand those kinds of transformations, that they're not the same as what's going on across the aisle, but that doesn't make them any less profound.
Well, Adam, take us back and lay out a bit of the political history background for our listeners. You set up the party structure of the New Deal order era, something with which a lot of our listeners would already be familiar. But you stressed that there is a turning point that it has gotten some attention, but perhaps deserves a lot more attention. That's the 1968 to 72 era that looms very large in your book, in which the Democratic Party had bookended disasters, the 68 convention and election, the 72 election. So take us back a little bit, talk in as much detail as you'd like about the party structure of the New Deal order era, and then how everything begins to change between 1968 and, let's just say, the immediate aftermath of the 72 election.
Mm-hmm. Well, as Joe, I'm sure you know, and many of your listeners know, the New Deal coalition inside the Democratic Party was a strange one. Despite, of course, making profound transformations in the constitutional order, the political order, and major changes to labor relations, the American welfare state, and so on, this was a coalition of pretty strange bedfellows, combining what other folks have described in detail some of the most progressive elements of American society, labor liberals, often in the North, the beginnings of the racial realignment, African-American voters beginning to move into the party of Roosevelt rather than the party of Lincoln. But on the other hand, this party had its historical home in the Jim Crow South, right? And the anti-union, racially conservative bloc of Southern conservatives, who not only had a lock on most of those Southern states, but by way of having a lock on those Southern states, had enormous amounts of leverage within Congress, on congressional committees, within the Senate, through the exercise of the filibuster and other forms of agenda control. And, you know, one, as my students usually ask me when I begin to describe a party coalition of such strange bedfellows, they ask, how on earth was this even possible? And one of the overlooked elements in existing literature on the New Deal coalition was the role that the party structure actually played in reproducing such a strange bedfellow coalition. And more precisely, the decentralized or confederal nature of the Democratic Party, where the party was less of a national organization that we think about today, and much more of a confederation of 50 different state parties. That structure and its decentralization operated or worked to reproduce this coalition without bringing these two mostly diametrically opposed wings into full-scale confrontation with each other. We saw some of the tectonic stresses within this coalition at various points throughout the New Deal period. The famous 1948 convention, Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, that after Hubert Humphrey walks up to the podium and gives his barn burner of a speech in favor of a strong civil rights plank that's thrown into the platform by a majority vote, some of the Southern delegation walks out, right, and starts the states' rights Dixiecrat Party, tries to sink Truman's reelection campaign. We saw it again in a few decades later, the 1964 Atlantic City Democratic National Convention, when the Mississippi Freedom delegates show up from Mississippi, a racially integrated delegation that defies the National Committee to reconcile Lyndon Johnson's commitment to civil rights. He had just passed the 1964, just signed into law the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and yet Southern delegations from those states were still excluding African Americans from participation. And so these were unreconciled contradictions brewing within the New Deal coalition, really, you know, from the start, 1935, 1937. But the decentralized structure of the Democratic Party, where the National Committee, the national institutions really had no capacity to impose a unified platform on all, you know, delegations, on all states, on all state parties, on all state committees, on their county committees, and so on. The decentralization is really what allowed or facilitated such a strange bedfellows coalition. But by the 60s, as these examples begin to intimate, labor liberals, racial liberals, the civil rights movements themselves began pushing on those decentralized mechanisms and attempting to break them or push them, trying to ripen those contradictions to a point where the Democratic Party as an institution would have to take a position on trying to reconcile its commitment, what the national platforms would say, right, and what the party was able to actually enact through Congress. So fast forward to 1968, and we have as you put it, the first bookend of this major crisis, the simultaneous insurgency of the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement, kind of domestic policy and foreign policy, those dimensions of the New Deal order, Great Society order, were unraveling rather quickly. And this is sort of engulfs the 1968 Chicago Convention into extreme controversy. Added on top of that, the insurgencies of Eugene McCarthy, Robert Kennedy, who was assassinated just shortly before the Chicago convention. And you have what I call in the book a full-scale party crisis. Lyndon Johnson withdraws from the race. Hubert Humphrey is nominated without contesting a single primary and goes on to lose to Richard Nixon. In that space, in that moment of crisis, I theorize a bit in the book and show empirically how a fairly small group of what I call party entrepreneurs were able to seize on that party crisis to diagnose what was ailing the party as a lack of democratic accountability over the leadership, a lack of representation within the party, and upon that diagnosis, promulgate a set of reforms that would dramatically transform the party structure, and they promised lead back to victory, resolve the crisis, and restore the post-war majority party to its majority status, they argued. Given the scale of the crisis, given the unpopularity of the Vietnam War, given the successes of the civil rights movement, most opponents of reform in that period of 1968, in that period of party crisis and right after it, did not have good arguments as to why these reforms were inappropriate. They were fairly uncontroversial modernizing reforms, like maybe, you know, when you select delegates for the nominating convention, it would be nice to know what candidate they supported before the public was able to vote for them through a primary or a caucus. It would be good to know the times and the meeting places of state party or county party conventions. Upon that, they also had more aggressive recommendations like affirmative action for people of color, women, and people under 30 years old, three groups that were conspicuously absent from most previous conventions. And through the through this 4-year period between 1968 and 1972, a commission called the McGovern-Fraser Commission, or its more official name, the Committee for the Committee on Party Structure and Delegate Selection, put forward a number of reforms. Many people were not paying attention. Many people thought they would be ineffective. But by the 1972 convention, when they had taken hold, when they had forced state parties to adhere to certain standard rules, standard operating procedures, and imposed the affirmative action guidelines, we saw an incredible insurgence of women, people of color, young people, anti-Vietnam War activists, feminists, civil rights activists, students, including fairly dissident or left-leaning union rank-and-file members, surge into the Democratic Party, surge into its governing mechanisms, its governing bodies, and nominate the prominent anti-war Senator George McGovern for the presidency. The second bookend, the second crisis that bookends this rather contentious period in Democratic Party politics is, of course, that McGovern goes on in the 1972 general election to lose every single state except Massachusetts and Washington, D.C. To Richard Nixon, thus closing or seeming to close at least the period of reform of the Democratic Party.
You know, it's interesting. There are a couple of points in the narrative where you've brought in some very good primary source information that really seems to encapsulate the narrative of the 68-72 period. Or we could say it's 68-74 because you extend it to the aftermath of the election and the rise of the Coalition for a Democratic Majority, the CDM, and these kind of counter reformers. But one is of the commission you mentioned, the McGovern-Fraser Commission, and they seemed to encapsulate exactly what so many of those new reformers, the new politics reformers you mentioned, wanted. I mean, if I can quote from your chapter on the party turned upside down, and this is from the 72 commission report: uprooting old entrenched customs of the past and replacing them with new and different procedures is not easy. Shifting to open participation by party rank and file members constitutes a virtual political revolution, including large numbers of women, young people, and minorities in national convention delegations, means turning years of tradition around. On that, I'm with your students in being really amazed at how the mid-20th century Democratic Party operated in comparison with the post-68 and post-72 party. Another great moment in that portion of the book is you mentioned in the 72 election and the aftermath, this, as you put it, the new class struggle, and a very telling point where the AFL-CIO did not endorse McGovern. Now, this may have been because George Meany felt disrespected, but still, our labor history listeners will understand that story. But it seems to me it's quite a harbinger of the party dynamic of the future, a combination of class-based and values-based politics that lifelong Democrats would consider tilting toward the Republican Party. And you know, that maybe the Coalition for a Democratic Majority symbolizes some of that. So can you talk also a little bit about the CDM after 72?
Yeah. Thank you for raising that. I was quite surprised as I was doing this research that in the similar way to how the crisis of 1968 opened a window of opportunity, if you will, for the reformers to step forward, to seize the moment, and to offer a plausible narrative about how the party can reform its way back to power. The 1972 election did the same for reform skeptics. Those who, after 1968, had in one way or another felt fairly compelled to bite their tongues, or to not bother organizing an active resistance to the implementation of the McGovern-Fraser reforms. However, after 1972, with McGovern's catastrophic landslide loss, those reform skeptics found the rationale that they had been lacking prior to or just after 1968, and that coalition that formed what they officially called the Coalition for a Democratic Majority, the CDM, that was a fairly diverse group of people, diverse in the sense of it attracted foreign policy hawks who had taken. Taken offense and bristled at George McGovern and the reform movement's alleged softness on communism, right? Their proposal for an immediate withdrawal from the Vietnam War that was still raging at that time. There were what we might consider to be cultural conservatives, those that bristled at the counterculture of the 1960s and 70s, who we would maybe later label neoconservatives, those who diagnosed what had gone wrong in the 1960s with the Democratic Party was the quote-unquote excesses of liberalism, the overextension of the welfare state, the model cities programs, the Great Society programs, that these had gone too far in creating dependency of those who were poor, and that traditional more mainstream constituencies were being neglected. So the CDM, notwithstanding the diversity of views in that coalition, they converged around the idea of resisting the reforms that they could set out, just like the reformers had after 1968. The CDM after 72 laid out a program to, if you will, reform the reforms, to roll back the reforms, to bring the party back to its New Deal past. Along these lines, they promoted rolling back the stringent affirmative action guidelines that had been imposed on most of the state parties and national bodies after 1968. They opposed what was the unfulfilled agenda of the reform movement to establish midterm policy conferences that would essentially be like presidential nominating conventions, but of course without nominating anybody. These would be national events for Democrats to gather together, debate strategy, debate program, whether they're in the majority or the minority. Presidents and party leaders may have to account for their performance in office. Things that, you know, if you're familiar with how many parties work in other advanced democracies, midterm policy conferences are not that unusual. They opposed the reformers' desire to implement a mass-based dues-paying membership. American parties sort of famously have historically lacked any kind of true membership. Anyone who identifies as a Democrat is considered a Democrat. Same thing on the Republican side. But nevertheless, the details can go on, but the CDM was able to mobilize in this moment, get themselves on the committees that were undertaking the reform agenda, and more or less torpedo most of that unfinished agenda. So many of the McGovern-Fraser reforms became codified into the party structure, and the CDM did not enjoy total victory in rolling those back. But they did enjoy some fairly important successes that did, in significant ways, mitigate or modify the party structure and the project that the reformers had initiated after 1968.
So bring us up to speed then with the changes of the Clinton-Obama era. We have the New Democrats or third way Democrats of the 1990s who have a mixed record of installing a kind of a durable moderate party agenda. And then Barack Obama in his 8 years as president has some successes and failures harnessing the advocacy party, to use your very very valid term, advocacy party. Talk a bit about that important transition.
Yeah, I trace in the post advocacy party period, that is the end of the struggle over between reformers and counter-reformers, I trace the patterns of Democratic Party governance through three successive Democratic presidents: Jimmy Carter's one term and rather unsuccessful bid at Democratic Party leadership, the rise of Bill Clinton and the New Democrats in the 1990s, and then Barack Obama. And all three really have quite different approaches to the advocacy party, to this configuration of a party that has fewer and fewer internal resources, what my colleagues Danny Schlossman and Sam Rosenfeld call a hollow party that institutionally has a limited capacity for electoral mobilization, a declining legitimacy in the public mind. These presidents had very different approaches to how they would try to lead and manage this structure that, of course, all three of them inherited, modified in some important ways, tried to channel or blunt in other ways, but all of whom had little choice over the matter as to take the party as they found it. So to focus in on the Clinton era, because this has received a considerable amount of attention in the scholarly literature, your listeners are probably familiar with the Third Way Project. It wasn't isolated to the United States, but could be seen in across liberal and social democratic countries around the world. But Clinton's attempt to carve a third way between Reagan Republicanism on the right and, you know, new politics, New Deal liberalism on the left had a big impact on the Republican Party. And we can point to very durable achievements associated with the new Democrats in trying to moderate the image of the of the Democratic Party by teaming up with the Republican Party to pass welfare reform in 1996, to enact NAFTA in the mid-1990s, to embrace a celebration of free markets and neoliberalism, to declare that the era of big government is over. These are all pretty memorable things from that period. But in my book, I take a look at the New Democratic Project as a party project, as one where the New Democrats thought they were going to be able to fundamentally challenge and subvert what I call the advocacy party configuration or order of the Democratic Party. That is, they wanted to diminish the dependence on what they considered to be electoral liabilities like feminism, like civil rights, the anti-war movement. Many of the legacies of the 1960s and 70s that were associated with the Democrats. And I argue in this part of the book that this challenge to the advocacy party was temporarily successful, but not durable. That is, under the Clinton era, they did successfully bring the party back to a presidential victory. In fact, Bill Clinton was the first to win re-election as a Democratic president since FDR. And so it seemed to many at the time that maybe the trouble of the 1960s and 70s, the struggle between reformers, counter-reformers, was in the past, was over. A new party order was being consolidated. But as I try and show, much of the language that was used by Clinton and the New Democrats did not hold much longer after 2000, after the turn of the millennium, after the New Democrats lost control of the party leadership. There are still members of Congress who identify themselves as New Democrats. But as partisan polarization has deepened, as hostility to a right-moving Republican Party has increased among Democratic activists, a moderate centrism has just not gained the traction that I think many of them thought that it would. I look instead at the way Barack Obama sort of embraced the advocacy party that he inherited after 2008, and I label him the advocate in chief, is rather than resisting, rather than trying to impose a new party order on top of the one that he found, in many ways, Barack Obama tried to use it to his advantage, establishing his own personal advocacy vehicle that sort of vacuumed up all the slogans and chants and even some of the personnel of environmentalism, immigrant rights, less so labor rights, women's advocates, and so on, and integrated them right into his brand, if you will, if you put it that way. And while he continued to, as most Democratic presidents do, underinvest in the organizational capacity of the formal institutions like the Democratic National Committee or the state committees in all 50 states, or even local organizations, Barack Obama was quite successful at becoming an advocate in chief. He even called himself a fierce advocate on behalf of these movements and causes that have associated themselves with the Democratic Party, or as sometimes I like to think of it, as that orbit the Democratic Party as if it was some kind of a, you know, planetary object or something.
Well, so since we're getting up to the end of our time here, Adam, let's think about in the post-Obama era, the time we're in now, the big questions are about, as you mentioned, partisan polarization, gridlock. There do not seem to be moderate members of either party now in the same way as there might have been just a few decades ago. So I want to read for you two quick quotes from your book, and I wonder if we can finish up with the bigger ideas of where we are today, where the Democratic Party in particular is today. One is, you mention at a few points, and I'll actually quote you here. This is a point you raise. It's a very valid one. The party became more open to new voices and identities, but it also facilitated the growth of presidential power, rising inequality, and deepening partisan polarization. That's quote one. And then you talk at various points about advocacy groups and their importance to us today. And you say dependence runs both ways. Parties need groups and groups need parties, end quote. Can you elaborate on those ideas and bring us up to speed with what your study tells us about these problems we face today? I mean, I know you're not writing a plan for how we get out of our troubles, but you do have a lot of food for thought for that this quest that we're all on to create a better polity. But can you talk a bit about those ideas in the amount of time we have left?
Yeah, I'd be pleased to do so. The aggrandizement of the executive, the rise of presidential unilateralism, increasing inequality, deepening partisan polarization, none of these are solely the result of the rise of the advocacy party. Obviously, these are large-scale, polity-wide, and rather durable trends in American political development, all of which are extremely important and extremely complex and pose major challenges for building that better, more inclusive polity. That said, this configuration of the Democratic Party does very little in terms of posing any kind of countervailing power to most of those trends. I'll swing back around to the inequality problem in just a minute, because I have recent developments have made me rethink that a little bit, but I'll return to it in a second. Social movements and advocacy groups that orient themselves around the Democratic Party place their demands on the Democratic Party for recognition, for rights, for policy, what some call ideological patronage. These groups collectively have, you know, of course, no direct interest in undermining the well-functioning of a democratic polity. But yet, as individuals, they know that the political agenda is finite, that we live in an era defined mostly by very fleeting moments of unitary, or I should say unified party control. Most of the time most of the time we live with divided government. And so when it is the case that the Democrats have unified control, or even just have control of the presidency, these groups are becoming increasingly vocal about seeing action now. That is the time scale and the logic of social movement activism, interest group lobbying, or advocacy on the behalf of those who have historically been marginalized, overlooked, or oppressed. Those are causes where it's very difficult to imagine that justice comes later, that justice comes eventually, or where presidents or other party leaders counsel patience. And so one of the things we've seen is, to take the Obama era as a quite a clear case of this, the use of executive action to do what the president can to satisfy many of those demands being lobbed at them from those groups that the party is dependent on for organizational capacity, electoral viability, popular legitimacy, and so on. Polarization, that increases polarization, even if polarization is one of the main reasons that bipartisan solutions to many of those social movement demands are not forthcoming. This also, I think, potentially has an effect on who is represented. And here we come to the inequality problem. As you quoted from the book, the advocacy party has diversified, not just the Democratic Party, but in turn, mainstream politics in a fantastic way that has created a more inclusive, multiracial democracy since the late 1960s, and one that recognizes inclusion along other lines of identity, including sexuality, gender, and ethnicity, and so on. However, the advocacy universe, if I could put it that way, has its own systematic silences within it. Perhaps most problematic in terms of the advocacy party has been the declining weight of labor unions in that ecology. Labor unions that while historically, as I demonstrate, especially in my book in the late 1960s, had some very problematic positions on building an inclusive polity, especially along certain axes and identity questions. Nevertheless, those groups did have extremely significant clout within the New Deal Democratic order, and use that muscle to negotiate redistributive policies that had broad downward effects on those with low incomes, those who are resource poor, and so on. Advocacy and social movement mobilization, while those are things that can and do mobilize people with less resources, people with a modicum of resources or abundant resources have an enormous advantage in making their voice louder, in impressing their demands onto the Democratic platform. And that has, for the most part, been a good thing in terms of that diversification that I was speaking of. But the advocacy universe is not itself representative of everybody in the American polity. And it's a concern of mine, and I know many people share this concern, that as unions have been declining in their clout in the private economy, the Democrats have not acted in a proactive way to try to rebuild unions' capacity to be an active political player within that coalition. That said, as I finish this book, since I finished this book, Joe Biden defeated Bernie Sanders for the Democratic nomination in 2020, and yet has initiated the boldest, most ambitious social and environmental policy agenda that anyone has seen since the 1960s. And many people were very surprised by this, myself included. But when I step back and I think about this, I think one of the ways this book speaks to that present moment is in two ways. One, Joe Biden seems to understand that he's inherited the advocacy party in the way that Barack Obama understood it. Now, Joe Biden, in many ways, is very different from Barack Obama, and I think cannot play the same role that he did. But nevertheless, he seems to have put a lot of priority. He seems to have prioritized going big, going bold on an agenda that pleases some of the most vocal advocates in the Democratic coalition. On the other hand, that coalition does seem to be broadly redistributive, despite the fact that the unions have continued to suffer major decline in the private economy and in the polity as a group of political actors. And where I think that comes from, and there more and more research is needed on this, but that as advocates are drawn together into a partisan coalition, as union members, those that still exist, establish LGBTQ caucuses within their union locals, as civil rights organizations create linkages and advocate on the behalf of raising minimum wage laws or protecting public sector unions. There's, I think, an aggregate or integrative effect of these distinct groups around a broadly redistributive program. I think the days of the Democratic Party being, quote unquote, just a coalition of single interest groups might actually be overlooking the coalitional effect, the partisan effect that occurs across these different groups. So notwithstanding the very serious and regrettable decline in the trade unions within the Democratic coalition, it seems like those that have increasing legitimacy, increasing clout along other sectors of the advocacy universe may themselves be taking up the banner for a broadly redistributive program. And so that's, to me, that is, we can understand that within the framework of contentious institutions and the advocacy party order. And I hope, maybe suggest that my concern about reproducing systematic inequalities may have been premature.
Well, Adam, that was a great answer to a very complicated question. And I appreciate you updating us and bringing us up to the period after you turned your manuscript in. There's so much more to talk about, but in the interest of time, we should call it there. Adam Hilton has been great. The title of the book is True Blues, The Contentious Transformation of the Democratic Party, available from the University of Pennsylvania Press, published in the year 2021. Adam Hilton, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Joe. It's my pleasure.
Take care.